listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ray Kurzweil has been an influential contributor to the field of artificial intelligence for quite a while now. In his seventh book, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed, he takes readers on a journey through the anatomy, functions, and evolution of the brain and explains how critical evolutionary features of the brain have had a direct role in our breakthroughs with technology, which in turn have led to a greater understanding of the mind. His book is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ray Kurzweil back to our show. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Leonard.
You received a degree in computer science and literature from MIT, so how did you become interested in how the brain and the mind function?
I've actually been interested in that for 50 years. And I actually wrote a paper 50 years ago. It was my Westinghouse Science Down Search submission saying the brain was a big pattern recognizer. That's what we did well, is recognize patterns. We weren't very good at logical thinking. And I got to meet President Johnson. I did a pattern recognition project of recognizing patterns in melodies and writing original music, and took that on the I've Got a Secret show. And I've been thinking about thinking for the past 50 years.
But we have to make a distinction between the brain and the mind?
Yes, the brain is a physiological thing that's in our skulls, and we can actually see inside it now, and we can see individual connections being formed and firing in real time. The mind is a brain that's conscious, has free will and identity. So it brings in these what are basically philosophical issues, and I talk about those also in the book.
And when you're talking about computers and computer engineering, you can find similarities with the brain, but what about the mind?
Well, that's a deep philosophical issue that goes back to Plato. We've been debating it for 2,000 years. My contention is that this will become a real practical issue. We will encounter machines that seem conscious, that we'll believe them when they say they're mad at us, and which we don't today. We meet the characters in video games and we don't take them seriously, but in the future we will. The primary purpose, though, of these intelligent machines is to make ourselves smarter, and they're doing that already. I felt during this one-day SOPA strike that a part of my brain had gone on strike, and so we're already dependent on these brain extenders. They literally, ultimately, will go inside our brains.
You couldn't go to Wikipedia, but Wikipedia isn't always correct.
It's pretty good, and you got all these other resources through Google and so forth that really do make us smarter.
In the case of computers right now, they do have similarities with the brain in that they can recognize patterns.
That's been my interest for 50 years. I mean, I developed the first character recognition and speech recognition, other technologies like that. And that is actually what the brain does well. And what's interesting is the techniques that we use in the artificial intelligence world turn out to be very similar to what the brain is actually doing. And it's not because we were copying the brain, because 10, 20, 30 years ago, we didn't know how the brain worked. It's only really over the past year that we could see inside the brain with enough precision to actually be able to determine what these methods are.
And it turns out that the brain and computers
are similar
than we thought?
Because the techniques that biological evolution evolved worked, and we discovered the same techniques in the artificial intelligence field, and so it evolved independently there. Now that we can actually determine the actual methods inside the brain, we can more precisely emulate it and create these biologically inspired methods. We already see very impressive results. Watson defeating the best two human players in the world at Jeopardy, which is a pretty complex game encompassing all of human knowledge and subtle forms of language. Systems like Siri or Google Now that are doing a pretty good job of answering your questions, getting better every week. The Google self-driving cars. I mean, machines are doing things that we used to associate only with human intelligence.
In the beginning of your book, you say that the most important project in the universe would be the reverse engineering of the human brain. What do you mean by that?
You know, it is our intelligence that's enabled us to do everything we do. We have this neocortex that's capable of thinking in hierarchies. Only mammals have them, and only humans have them at a rich enough scale to have created language and technology and invention and art and science and music. And we are actually learning how that works, and we'll be able to actually extend our hierarchical thinking with our technology. And that will enable us to solve all the grand challenges of humanity. Intelligence is the most important force in the universe, if you will, and we're going to be able to expand it. We are already by creating these intelligent machines based on our understanding of how the human brain works.
Do we know whether the neocortex was of the sort that humans have were in the brains of hominids that preceded us or the Neanderthals?
Well, yes. The neocortex evolved first with mammals. So 100 million years ago, these little rat-like creatures had a postage stamp-sized neocortex. It was flat, as thin as a postage stamp, but it did enable them a little bit of thinking in hierarchy, so they could learn new skills. So when the Cretaceous extinction event happened, this cataclysmic environmental change 65 million years ago, the mammals were able to adapt, and the non-mammalian species could not. And tens of thousands of those species died out, and the mammals kind of took over their ecological niche.
Because the neocortex motivates us with fear
and
pleasure.
It enables us to learn new skills that are complex and hierarchical. Mm-hmm. Other animals without a neocortex would require thousands of years to learn a new skill, basically by having their behavior evolve using biological evolution, not by figuring it out in the span of one lifetime. So with the sudden cataclysmic change in the environment, which occurred 65 million years ago, many of these non-mammalian species died out. And then the neocortex kept growing in size and complexity. By the time you get to primates, it's very convoluted. It has all these fissures and curves and convolutions to extend its surface area. In the human brain, it's 80% of the mass of the brain. But it's still actually a flat structure if you were to stretch it out. But it's actually that greater quantity, primarily, of neocortex in our big foreheads, the frontal cortex, that enabled us to create language and art and science and so on.
So the neocortex is the area where we recognize, remember, and predict patterns?
Right, and that's principally what the human brain does. And the patterns can be simple patterns like the crossbar and a capital A, or they can be complex patterns like she's pretty, that was ironic, that was funny. And you probably think that the pattern recognizers dealing with those high-level features are much more complex and sophisticated. They're actually the same recognizer, except that they exist at the top of this conceptual hierarchy because you have patterns feeding up to a higher level. And then the pattern recognizers are higher level, feeding up to yet higher levels. So things like irony are at a very high level. Now, where does that hierarchy come from? We're actually not born with it. We create that with every thought we think.
And do people who, for example, live in the Amazon as hunter-gatherers, do they have a sense of irony too?
I would think so. They certainly have the capability, but a lot of this hierarchy is sort of augmented by the culture we've created. So the whole invention of science and technology and art and the sophistication of language has helped us think in this hierarchical manner. But the hierarchical nature of language comes from the hierarchical nature of the neocortex itself.
My guest is Ray Kurzweil, whose latest book is How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. And what happens when one of these pattern-recognizing areas in the brain is damaged?
Well, that's a very good question, because neuroscience has been very fond of the idea of specialization, that here's this one region, the fusiform gyrus, and it's very good at recognizing faces. And V1, that's very good at recognizing edges in objects and so on.
And when we have a stroke, one of those areas might be destroyed, and then...
Right, and then another area will take over. It takes time.
Sometimes people never learn to talk again.
Well, actually, there's a lot of plasticity. One of the problems is that these other areas aren't sitting around doing nothing. They've already learned other skills, are hesitant to give up those new skills. each one of these patterns is learned with a great deal of redundancy, so we can give up a certain amount of redundancy to learn new skills. But here's an interesting piece of research. What happens to this area called V1, which typically processes very primitive patterns in visual images, like edges of objects and primitive shapes? What happens to it in a congenitally blind person? Because it's not getting any visual image. Does it sit there doing nothing? It actually gets harnessed by the frontal cortex to help it deal with high-level language concepts, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of sophistication. So rather than these primitive patterns, it's recognizing very sophisticated patterns, showing that the algorithm if not identical, very similar across the entire neocortex. And that's one of the messages of my book. There's a universal algorithm across all of these pattern recognizers. And I've actually quantified that. We have 300 million pattern recognizers. They're recognizing patterns simultaneously. So every moment, we are recognizing hundreds of millions of patterns in this elaborate hierarchy.
The primary thesis of this book is this pattern recognition theory of mine, shortened to PRTM. What does PRTM tell us about the functions of the brain other than the recognition of these patterns? It's got to lead to something larger than that, doesn't
it? Well, the secret of the neocortex is that it's able to build these hierarchies based on its own experience and its own thinking. I have a one-year-old grandson now, and I can see him laying down one conceptual layer at a time, which is what we're basically capable of doing. So he's already has under his belt a few layers and is learning more and more sophisticated ones. We continue doing that as adults. We need to learn prerequisites before we learn a new subject. We have an added challenge because by the time we're 20, we have filled up those 300 million pattern recognizers, these little modules that are repeated across the brain. That's why a child can learn a new language so easily. They have this virgin neocortex. But we create this hierarchy on our own. So it's true you are what you eat, but it's even more true that you are what you think. We can actually see this now in brain scans. We can see your brain create your thoughts, but we can see your thoughts create your brain because it's in these connections between the modules which establishes this hierarchy of our thinking.
Well, but we're talking about patterns here. A child very early develops bonds with his mother, for example, and love doesn't seem to me to be something about patterns. It seems to be something of a very different sort, just like free will or the concept of free will seems to be something.
Well, we still have the old brain, and the old brain provides the basic source of our motivations, of affection, of aggression, of sexual desire. It's mediated, though, now through the neocortex. So the neocortex is like a big bureaucracy or a sublimator. So sexual aggression may get translated into writing poetry by the neocortex. It takes on a completely different character. But the old brain is with us, and that provides our fears and our motivations. And so it's a combination of the two. Free will is now a much more mysterious subject because
some people don't even believe it exists.
Well, that's right. I talk about some experiments in the book where we actually start carrying out certain decisions before we're consciously aware that there's a decision to be made. We become aware of a decision, we make the decision, but meanwhile we've actually already carried out the muscle actions to implement that decision. So it's almost like, you know, the bureaucracy telling the president after the mission has been accomplished about the mission, and the president approves it, but the mission's already been carried out. And of course, we knew that a lot of what goes on in the neocortex, in fact, most of it, is unconscious. It's probably a bad defense in a murder case. Yes, I killed the victim, but I wasn't paying attention. But in fact, we're not paying attention to most of what goes on in the neocortex.
My guest is Ray Kurzweil, who's book, The Singularity Is Near, was a New York Times bestseller. His latest is How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. It is published by Viking. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ray Kurzweil, a futurist, an inventor, an entrepreneur, and author of 7 books, the most recent, How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. It is published by Viking. Your first entrance into the field of pattern recognition was in 1965, when you built a computer that could compose music?
It was my first pattern recognition project that fed in melodies, say, of Chopin or Mozart, and it would find the patterns and write original music that had never been written before, but use the same patterns. So you could recognize.
So you could write a Chopin-like piece?
Right. It sounded like maybe a second-rate student of Chopin. So I was one of the winners of the Westinghouse, now it's called Intel, Science Talent Search, and met President Johnson.
And computers were very different in those days. Would it be a lot easier to build a computer today?
They were the same concept, although the computer on my belt is a billion times more powerful per dollar than the student I used when I was an undergraduate at MIT, because they're basically doubling in power for the same cost every year. That's another principle that I talk about called the law of accelerating returns. And so we have the opportunities to use more and more powerful hardware. That's only one of the prerequisites to creating intelligent machines. We have to have the right methods, too. But our insight into the brain is also expanding exponentially. Spatial resolution of brain scanning is doubling every year. The amount of data we're getting is doubling every year. The precision of simulating brain regions is doubling every year. We can actually see now the brain creating your thoughts. And I provide actually a description of the basic algorithm that the neocortex uses. And the evidence for that has just recently come out.
Does the Heisenberg principle apply when we're doing an MRI of what's firing off in the brain when we're going through some thought processes?
Well, there's some basic uncertainty, which can either come from the uncertainty of quantum events or just...
I'd be aware that I'm being watched at that moment. I don't know whether my brain is wary of that invasion of its privacy.
It's interesting... thought. Lots is going on in our brain that we're not aware of. And,
I threw that at you.
Once we start actually probing inside the brain, we won't necessarily know if people are spying on us, just as we don't know if people are spying on our personal computers today.
You mentioned Siri. You made contribution to the technology behind Siri, didn't you?
Well, I developed the first text-to-speech synthesis and the first large vocabulary, speech recognition. Those technologies are now with Nuance, which is one of the leaders in speech technologies. That was a company I founded originally. It's Kurzweil Computer Products. And Nuance has contributed many of the technologies in Siri.
And you mentioned the law of accelerating returns, or is it pronounced LOAR or L-O-A-R?
Just law of accelerating returns.
So what happens is you come up with something like speech recognition, and then suddenly 85 other people are on the case, and we have a whole bunch of things that nobody could have imagined until that moment?
Well, these technologies keep getting better. At least the resources we can put into them grows exponentially, and exponential is very explosive. If you double something 30 times, you've multiplied it by a billion. And that's what we've done, even just since I was a student.
Well, when are predictions linear and when are they exponential?
Basically, they're linear when a technology is not an information technology, like, say, transportation today, or like health and medicine was up until recently. Now that we've actually reverse engineered the genome, health and medicine has become an information technology, and it's going to progress exponentially.
Do our brains possess the ability for exponential growth, or is that exclusive to non-biological technology?
Well, our biological brain is not going to change much. Biological evolution is continuing, but at a pace that's a million times slower than technology. Our non-biological intelligence is going to expand exponentially, especially once we can really capture human levels, which I've predicted will happen by 2029. But even today, we have systems that operate on similar principles, you know, like Siri or Google Now or Watson, that are actually developing these hierarchical probabilistic models of and can understand human language. Watson actually read all of Wikipedia. That's how it got its knowledge. And
but then it had to understand the process by of that show where you ask, you answer with a question.
Right.
And it did very well. It took a long time for them. They had to keep on correcting it until Watson actually was able to do that.
They had to fine-tune it for the rules of that game and, you know, figure out the right probabilities. But it actually got a higher score than the best two human players put together.
Mm-hmm.
And it is based on actually understanding natural language. It read 200 million documents and understood them well enough to find the right answer in 3 seconds.
In addition to reference to voice recognition technology like Siri, you also helped pioneer text-to-speech synthesizers and CCD flatbed scanners, which led to the development of print-to-speech reading technology. That's called the Kurzweil Reading Machine?
Well, the Kurzweil Reading Machine combined 3 new technologies: the ability to recognize print in any type style, text-to-speech synthesizers, flatbed scanning, all of which are ubiquitous technologies today. And
that's the GPS voice that usually mispronounces words, but that's still I was in French Canada, and they kept on telling me to go on Rue Saint-Estephe. But I could figure out what it was trying to say.
Well, I think they do a little bit better job today.
Oh, this was this summer.
But that's why I got into technology forecasting, because I wanted my technologies to make sense when I finished the project, not when I started it. And the world is changing very quickly. I mean, think back 3 or 4 years ago, we didn't have social networks or wikis or blogs. These technologies expand at an exponential pace, and at each point, new ideas become feasible that were completely impractical before.
Can you tell us about your partnership with Stevie Wonder?
That actually goes back, let's see, to 36 years ago. I demonstrated the Kurzweil Reading Machine on the Today Show, and he had heard that and called me up and came over and took the first Kurzweil Reading Machine. We then developed a friendship, and a few years later, he was challenging me to create a music synthesizer that could recreate the sounds of real grand pianos and orchestral instruments. And we started Kurzweil Music Systems together. In 1984, we had the first computer synthesizer that could really replicate the grand piano.
Because that was a concern in the past. The synthesizers sounded always like synthesizers.
Right. It introduced a new class of sounds, but it couldn't really recreate the beautiful sounds of choice of 19th century instruments. And now you could actually create new sounds that were completely synthetic, but had the complexity and richness of a piano sound. And so it introduced a whole new era of computer music. And it's still a major synthesizer brand.
So is that what he recorded songs like Superstition on?
He may have. There's a whole series of albums in the 70s and 80s that he used the Kurzweil Reading Machine, Kurzweil synthesizer.
My guest is Ray Kurzweil, whose latest book is How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Of the 7 books you've published, 3 were on dieting and longevity. But here we are talking about your main area of expertise, computer science. What interests you in dieting and longevity? And do you see them as related?
You know, they weren't related when I started. I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes 30 years ago. I developed my own approach and wrote a I've had no indication of type 2 diabetes for 25 years, and I wrote a best-selling health book about that. Recently, health and medicine has become basically computer science. We're understanding the information processes underlying biology. We have these little software programs called genes that govern much of our lives, and we can actually update this outdated software. So I became interested in it because of my interest in staying healthy. My father died prematurely of heart disease, and I probably would have gotten that too if I didn't take a proactive role.
So when people looked at your credentials and saw that you're writing a book on diet, did they still take you seriously?
Well, I think so. Fantastic Voyage had 2,000 scientific citations. I wrote it with a leading medical physician in this area, Dr. Terry Grossman. So the book has been very influential. And it really talks about an era where health and medicine has become an information technology. We can understand it in those terms.
You discuss nanotechnology in this book. Is it possible that it'll be available to the general public in the near future? Is it? Could it prolong life?
Well, in these books, we talk about three bridges to radical life extension. And bridge one is what you can do right now, some of which is practical advice on nutrition and exercise, supplementation. Biotechnology is the next bridge. We're going to really reprogram our genes, just like you update the software in your cell phone. We're going to update the software in our bodies, and there's many examples.
Am I going to have to sign into a two-year plan every time?
Well, you're going to want to keep updating it. The period of updates is going to get faster and faster as the technology improves. The third bridge is nanotechnology. There's already interesting experiments in animals. That's still, I think, a couple of decades away from practical use. But one scientist cured type 1 diabetes with a blood cell-sized device that has 7-nanometer pores that lets insulin out in a controlled fashion. So those are very intriguing examples. But the revolution that's happening right now is in biotechnology. You can fix, for example, a damaged heart. 50% of all heart attack survivors have damaged their heart. My father died of that condition in the 60s. There was nothing you could do about it then, or even up until just recently. But now you can fix that with stem cell therapies.
And how long do you see life being extended into the future?
You know, it's not a fixed amount because each of these developments adds more time and gets us to a future time, allowing us more time to add more time. And we're going to get to a point where we're adding more time than is going by. And I see that point, which is a tipping point, is only maybe 15 years away.
And then there are people who say, I'm not sure I want to live to 150 or 200.
They say that now, but you know, people say, oh, I don't want to live to be more than 100. And I'd like to see them say that when they're 100, because I've talked to 100-year-olds, and they do want to live to 101.
You mentioned that the Blue Brain Project is in the process of trying to recreate the neocortex. Is the neocortex the biggest hurdle in reverse engineering the brain?
The neocortex is where we do our thinking. So, yes, it's an important region. We still have the old brain that provides our motivations, our fears, and so on. But 80% of the brain, and I would say probably 80% of the importance, is in the neocortex. And the purpose of a simulation project like Blue Brain is not so much that that's the right way to build artificial intelligence, but that's the way to verify that our theories of how the neocortex works are accurate, because it's trying to simulate at the molecular level.
Do all scientists go along with your ideas about the neocortex?
Well, we'll see. The book just came out last week. So far, it's gotten very good reviews. I think it's pulling together a lot of research, which is very new. So a lot of neuroscience has been looking at very narrowly, what does this region do, what does that region do, without trying to find an overall coherent theory that ties all these observations together, which I think we're just now in a position to begin to do.
There are people who are concerned that we are becoming over-dependent on technology. All of your predictions have to do with technology growing better and better, I guess, from your point of view, perhaps.
Well,
not
we
from
are
everyone's
dependent
point of view.
On technology. People say, well, people won't want to use these technologies. How many people opt out today? I mean, how many people don't use cell phones and Wikipedia and Google and or some equivalent thereof?
Some very annoying friends of mine don't have cell phones, but except for them, yeah.
Well, you know, maybe the Amish opt out of 20th century technologies, but It's a relatively small group, but it's not one thing. I mean, we have millions of choices, and you know, some people are early adopters, some people are late adopters, but these technologies have enhanced human life. Human life expectancy was 20 a thousand years ago. It was 37 in 1800, 48 in 1900. You know, people were very poor. Even before 1930, we couldn't afford Social Security. So the world is getting better, and it's because of the advance of technology.
What else do you see lying ahead?
We're going to spend more and more of our time in virtual reality. We're going to be able to reprogram our way from diseases. We're going to have intelligence in these various brain extenders. So search engines won't just be based on keywords. They'll actually have read everything on the web and every book and understand the concepts. They'll be listening in to your conversations, both written and verbal, and actually, if you let them, which I believe people will, because they will be very like a useful friend that will sort of pop in saying, oh, you know, you were thinking yesterday about this supplement and how it's bioavailable. Well, here's a new research study came out 36 minutes ago that speaks to that, or that actress you were trying to find this morning, it's so-and-so, and here's background about it. It'll be like an assistant who actually answers your questions before you're even aware you have a question.
We have very little time, but I was wondering about the Singularity University. Aside from writing books and doing your research, you've co-founded that. What's its purpose?
It's based on studying, first of all the things we've been talking about, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, nanotechnology, and then figuring out how can we apply these technologies to overcoming the major challenges of humanity.
Is this an accredited university?
It's different. It's a graduate study program. It's sponsored in part by Google. NASA's provided a permanent campus. The motto is learn by doing. So the students spend a lot of their time self-organizing into teams to take on some major challenge, like the availability of clean water or housing, using these exponentially growing technologies. And whether they succeed in solving these problems or not, our idea is that they will learn something by actually attempting to accomplish a project.
Ray Kurzweil's latest book is How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. It's published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's my pleasure.